Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Major League Baseball has a new labor agreement, but can the NBA get its act together? Ahead on Only a Game, the latest sports labor news, also why tailgaters are increasingly targeted by advertisers, and remembering the great New York Knicks teams of the early 70s featuring Clyde, Earl the Pearl, Dollar Bill, and the Captain. Also ahead, video gamers revel in their Major League status.
A few months ago, we won the $1 million tournament, so I personally made $100,000 just off one tournament, so it's pretty good.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Early this morning, the NBA owners and players reached a tentative agreement ending the 149-day lockout that had threatened to wipe out the 2011-2012 season. The details of the tentative agreement have not been announced, but previous negotiations had involved a 50-50 split of so-called basketball-related income and the owners' determination to cap spending in various ways so as to develop a system more favorable to small-market teams. Commissioner Stern announced that the season, which will include 66 games, will begin on December 25th, though the precise schedule was not made available. Training camps will begin on December 9th. What has been termed a handshake deal must still be ratified by both sides, but both sides seem optimistic that there will be an NBA season. Amidst the backdrop of the Penn State scandal, conference realignment, and proposed changes to the bowl championship series format, the nation's best college football teams are aiming to sort out which will go to what 2011 bowls. Here to discuss some of this weekend's best rivalry week matchups is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me back.
Number 3 Arkansas jumped out to a 14-0 lead against number 1 LSU yesterday, and then LSU outscored them for the remainder of the game 41-3 and won the game. Is there any doubt that LSU is the best team in the nation?
Well, I guess we'll find out if they have to play Alabama again, but no, not right now. There'd be no doubt. They've beaten 7 ranked teams, one at Alabama, number 3 team twice, Oregon at one point, and then Arkansas now fairly handily. So I don't think there's any question they have the best resume. They are in a position now where they can easily lose next week's Southeastern Conference championship game and advance to the BCS title game anyway. So they've put a resume together that is pretty much foolproof, unless they would lose by like 50 points next week, they're in.
Hence, scoring all those extra points yesterday.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there are style points, and running up the score is part of the game in college football.
Number 24, Auburn, will host arch rival number 2, Alabama, today. If the Tigers can upset Alabama, would it have significant BCS implications?
Yeah, absolutely. Alabama is in if it wins. There's almost no scenario where they would be dropped out of the top two. So they're 21 point favorites today. Game is at Auburn. It is a huge rivalry game. This is not, though, a great Auburn team. It's not a terrible one. I think they should be able to give Alabama a game, but I think Alabama can win the game. But Alabama wins. They're in the pretty much you can take the month of December off for college football. It'll be LSU Alabama in early to mid January for the title.
Which of today's other key games should we be talking about?
Well, you still have Oklahoma and Oklahoma State playing. Oklahoma State will probably be left out on the side for the BCS championship game, but they can finish 11-1 and win a huge game against their Bedlam rival in the state of Oklahoma and advance to probably the Fiesta Bowl. It'll be a big win. Virginia Tech and Virginia are playing for a share of the ACC championship. That's not a bad game. And then the other one that has some significance is Wisconsin and Penn State. Not only the Penn State, the whole Penn State story, they are still alive for the winner of that would go to the Big Ten championship game a week later. None of these on the national scale would have a whole lot of impact, although Oklahoma State could. But there's certainly regional interest in it and a pretty good rivalry. And then you just have all your other rivalry games, Washington State, and Florida, Florida State, and Clemson and South Carolina, and all the different ones that sort of make up the fabric of college athletics where you just have, you know, it doesn't really matter what the record is, how good you are. It's always a fun time.
Last week, it was reported that BCS members were considering a number of radical changes, including severing ties with the Sugar, Fiesta, Orange, and Rose Bowls and focusing solely on a national championship game featuring the number one and number two teams and eliminating automatic BCS Bowl qualifying status currently enjoyed by the six major conferences. What do you make of these proposals, and would they improve the BCS, of which you have, of course, been so critical?
Well, I think the elimination of the automatic qualifying conferences, there are six of them, despite being 11 conferences. So unlike any other sport, if you can win your conference and not advance, because they deem some conferences more legitimate than others, that is a direct response to government threats for antitrust violation cases. And then that's a clear response to the antitrust threat that nobody wants to deal with. In terms of going to just two teams, and remaining as a two-team playoff, if you will, and not expanding to at least four, if they can make it into a four-team playoff at the very least, then it would be a massive step forward for the sport. It's been a terrible season on the field. Financially, this system is a disaster for these public universities. It's a financial albatross on college athletics. It's riddled with scandal, corruption, cronyism, all different things. They got to do something. How far you can pry yourself free from that, and these university presidents and athletic directors are willing to make the right move for the actual sport, we'll see.
Dan Wetzel is a national columnist for Yahoo Sports, and he's our college gridiron guy here at Only a Game. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
It's another fall weekend in the U.S., and that means tailgating. By all accounts, tailgating is at an all-time high in popularity. You might even be listening to our show right now from a wonderland of folding chairs, portable grills, and coolers. If that's the case, don't be surprised if you encounter some sort of advertising as you chow down on that burger or enjoy the beverage. From WFAE in Charlotte, Scott Graff has more now on one of the newest frontiers in sports marketing.
Don't let Bernard Arthur's accent fool you. He's a native of South Africa, but now lives in North Carolina. And judging by what he, his wife, and three friends spent on a recent tailgate, he's got this American tailgating thing down pat.
Somewhere in the region of about $200, $250, that's about what we would spend between food and drinks and, you know, everything else that goes along with it.
Arthur and his group drink beer and play cornhole in the sunshine before a recent NASCAR race in Charlotte. Catch Arthur on the Sunday morning of a Carolina Panthers home game, and he'll be tailgating there, too. Altogether, Arthur guesses he spends between $1,000 and $2,000 each year on tailgating. And to him, it's money well spent.
There's a sense of being a social being, right? So you want to get out there and be part of the atmosphere. I think when you think of going to any sporting event or any tailgating event, there's a camaraderie of who you support and getting out there and being a part of the group.
About 51 million people tailgate every year in the United States. They spend about $20 billion a year.
That's Joe O'Brien. He knows a thing or two about tailgating. One, he lives in Minnesota and has downed plenty of beer and brats before Vikings, Gophers, and Twins games. And two, he helps run the St. Paul-based American Tailgaters Association. It's an organization dedicated to those who love to eat and drink outside before sporting events. And he says these days, that group is bigger than ever.
Tailgating used to be viewed as kind of a fringe group of people. The popular perception was that it was a bunch of crazy people out in the parking lot, drinking too much beer, having a lot of fun, making a lot of noise. The fact is it's evolved into a very family-oriented, very socially acceptable pastime.
As tailgating has grown, advertisers have taken note. O'Brien says he first started noticing TV ads aimed at tailgaters about 5 years ago. And with every year, he sees more and more.
Hey, I'm Ndamukong Suh, and I think no matter where you're tailgating, It's always great when you're serving Omaha Steaks, the official sponsor of tailgating.
Watch a football game this weekend and you're likely to see ads like this one, or ones promoting charcoal or car insurance or even portable generators. And it's not just TV advertising. Part of what O'Brien does at the American Tailgaters Association is connect sponsors to sports fans by actually organizing huge tailgates. In North Carolina, Todd Hirschfeld runs a similar body, the National Tailgating League. Beer, barbecue sauce, and even companies that sell pain relievers hire him to get their products into the hands of tailgaters.
Some of these clients are more interested in getting, you know, hand-to-hand combat or one-to-one interaction with the consumer. They're going to have a much better chance doing it in the tailgate parking lot than they are inside a stadium of 160,000 people through a billboard or through, you know, something inside the track.
Hirschfeld and O'Brien both hold up sausage maker Johnsonville as a leader in this arena. Jim Miller is a marketing manager for Johnsonville. He says when you're selling brats, stadium signs and TV ads are okay to a point. But by targeting tailgaters at the game, Johnsonville is able to put its product right into the hands, make that mouths, of a huge target audience.
Because we believe when we get people to try our product, we build fans.
The strategy makes a lot of sense to Paul Swangard. He's a sports marketing professor at the University of Oregon. He says reaching out to people while they're having fun is smart advertising.
You know, you're not yet focused on the game, but your passions are running deep. You're excited about what's going to happen. You haven't been yet disappointed by a bad performance of your team on the field. You're surrounded in a community of friends and companies, you know, would love to communicate with you when you're in that frame of mind, and then you have a viable way to maybe sell some more product on the back end of that experience.
But does this kind of advertising actually work? It depends on who you ask. Swangard and those who spend money on it say yes, if it's done right. But Bernard Arthur, the fan we met earlier, isn't so sure. In the sky above his NASCAR tailgate, airplanes pulled big, bright banners.
I just asked a question a second ago, so I was watching the planes overhead, wondering, okay, why is Geico and why is Wells Fargo, like, who's really paying attention to that? I just asked the group that, and I don't know if anyone's paying attention to that.
Arthur goes on to say he thinks a more effective way of advertising to sports fans is in the grocery store when they're there actually stocking up for their tailgate. Meanwhile, the American Tailgaters Association says research it's done suggests the number of Americans who tailgate is growing by about 3 or 4% each year. And as that happens, so does the likelihood that those who tailgate will see even more advertising aimed squarely at them. For Only a Game, I'm Scott Graff in Charlotte.
He's lighting up the charcoal lights and down the long necks, acting a fool with a bunch of crazy rednecks, partying harder than all the frat boys around. All bets are off once you put the tailgate down. Cover his body in war paint.
Put a phone. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Go on and hike the Alps if you've the legs to make the trip. It's best to be quite careful because you wouldn't want to slip. But hike across the Alps if you've the money for the stuff that you will need to keep the hike from being really rough. But though this is a lot to know, it isn't quite enough. You cannot hike the Alps, my friend, if you are in the buff. A fellow trying to do that found that what I've said is true. A judge in Zurich fined him, and he'll do the same to you. So if you hike the Alps someday, as everybody knows, you'll want to wear your hiking boots and also all your clothes. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, remembering the Knicks teams that are really worth remembering. We'll have to go back 4 decades for that. But first, while the NBA and the entity formerly known as the Union were girding for legal battle, Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association announced the successful completion of a new collective bargaining agreement, meaning that there will be no work stoppages in baseball for at least 5 years. Tuesday's agreement expands the playoff field from 8 teams to 10, establishes blood testing for human growth hormone, and contains new rules intended to create greater competitive balance between the large and the small market teams. Joining me now to evaluate the new agreement is Jonah Carey of Grantland. Jonah, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote this week that the biggest change evident in the new agreement would seriously restrict teams inclined to spend a lot of money signing amateur players in the U.S. and players from other countries, and you suggest this could harm the game. How?
Well, you talked about that Major League Baseball is emphasizing the improvement of competitive balance. I maintain that it actually hurts competitive balance, and potentially significantly. They are basically capping the amount that you can spend on the draft and on international signings, and the way that they're capping it is if you go over by a certain amount, you have to pay some pretty harsh penalties, including forfeiting future first-round draft picks, which are very valuable. Mm-hmm. This isn't necessarily a huge problem for the Yankees and the Red Sox, because although they do tend to go over what's called the slot recommendation, they have the ability to spend $200 million on a free agent, too. But the Pittsburgh Pirates don't have that ability, and the Cincinnati Reds don't have that ability, and teams of that nature don't have that ability. So they're the ones that are going to get hurt, and in fact, they're the ones that have spent very aggressively on the draft and international signings. When this rule takes effect, you're going to see some big changes in the ability of those teams to keep up with the big boys.
You've also suggested that the new agreement may deprive Major League Baseball of some terrific athletes. Is that just because the NFL and the NBA, assuming it ever plays games again, can offer young athletes more money earlier in their careers? Because that's always been the case, hasn't it?
Well, sort of. I mean, if you think about it from the beginning, baseball actually has the ability to offer money earlier because they're offering money when you're a teenager and you go play in the minor leagues for a while. So if you're a number one draft pick, you might make $2 million to go ride the bus in Wisconsin for a couple of years. So that's great. That's fine. But then what happens is once you become a rookie, yes, it does change dramatically, particularly in the NFL where they really front load the contracts. You obviously have a short shelf life in the NFL, so it makes sense to pay someone up front because by the time you're 30, you might be done, or even 28, you might be done. But, you know, you have a situation now where that money is going to be cut. And so, yes, you'd still make more money as an 18-year-old if you opt to play baseball than if you decide to play, let's say, quarterback in Michigan. But it's pretty attractive to play quarterback in Michigan. Then you're playing quarterback in Michigan. You're the big man on campus. You might go to the NFL. That's all great. That has some appeal. And if the financial incentive isn't as strong to give all that up, maybe you decide, I want to go do that. Maybe I want to be the point guard of Kentucky. Maybe I want to be a striker for AC Milan and pursue soccer. These are all possibilities. And Major League Baseball is potentially hurting itself by opening up the door for those possibilities.
Commissioner Selig has been saying all along that his greatest concern was to increase the ability of small market teams to be competitive with the Yankees and the Red Sox. Is there anything in the new agreement likely to bring about that result?
Well, the wild cards certainly help a little bit. If you have two more teams making the playoffs every year, that obviously opens the door to potentially teams that were on the fringe. Maybe they would have won 85 games, maybe through pluck and will and some good luck they got there, but fell a little bit short. I wrote a book about the Tampa Bay Rays called The Extra 2%, came out earlier this year, mm-hmm. and it talked about their success, and they've made the playoffs now 3 times in the last 4 years, but it's a Herculean struggle every year to get past one of the Yankees or the Red Sox. Now it's a little bit easier for them, and if you want to stay with the AL East, it's probably a little bit easier for the Toronto Blue Jays, which they do play in a big market, but still an up-and-coming franchise trying to make hay. Now they have a little bit of better chance to get in. So that's probably the main concession. And there's also some minor tweaks to revenue sharing, which basically, to boil it down, mean that it's going to be a little bit more fair than it used to be. But I still maintain that you're seeing more harm than good for the teams that, again, are not the Yankees and the Red Sox.
Regarding human growth hormone, now there can be testing starting next spring, but there are a lot of restrictions on when the testing can occur and what has to be believed before it can occur. Has Major League Baseball addressed this issue responsibly and effectively?
Well, I think the issue is kind of overblown anyway. We've seen no proper longitudinal studies that show that HGH absolutely improves performance. We have a lot of anecdotal stuff. We have people with big muscles, but we don't really know all that much. And so I'm one that's going to come down on the side of, I don't know, I guess kind of a little bit of a libertarian view. I understand that it's against the rules, and so you have to enforce the rules such as they are. I just don't think that other than the aspect of are you – obeying the rules or not, that it necessarily makes a huge pragmatic difference in the game. If enforcement is lax or not as tough as you'd like it to be or not at the right time, I don't necessarily think that means that people are going to hit 90 home runs in a season. We've seen a lot of that been curtailed for various reasons, and I don't necessarily think that PED testing is the only reason or maybe even the principal reason. I think that there's better pitching and there are other reasons involved too. But yeah, I mean, such as it is, if you are a big believer in that testing is very important, I'm not, but if you are, then sure, I guess you can make the case that they have not necessarily gone far enough.
Other proposed changes include a higher minimum salary for Major League Baseball players, the requirement that players use a new and improved batting helmet starting in 2013, and now players and managers are going to be required, if they use smokeless tobacco, to do it furtively. Have I got that about right?
Yeah, furtively is a good way to put it. You can sort of get away with it, but don't show the fans and don't do things of that nature. Listen, a lot of this is PR. You know, that's just how it goes. If you have a bulge in your back pocket, you better have some. You better have Big League Chew back there. That's all I can tell you. Yeah, it's a funny situation, and I get that. The batting helmets make a little bit more sense. I mean, that's a safety issue, and we've seen that. I mean, quite frankly, to me, the people that are the most defenseless are pitchers. We've seen a few pitchers, Kazushi, the former Dodgers pitcher, and a couple others. They've been hit with line drives in the head in the past. And I mean, you know, I think that you could get to the point where you could see pitchers wearing some sort of protective headgear. You see that in some other countries on occasion. So, you know, I think that's sort of the next step. But in the here and now, we have a helmet that can protect you against a 100-mile-an-hour fastball. At least that's what they claim. I mean, that's a good thing. I don't think it's going to be a problem. I don't think hitters are going to hit for lower averages because they're bothered by their helmet. I just think it helps the safety of the game. I'm totally fine with that.
Jonah Carey blogs about sports for Grantland, and he's the author of The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team from Worst to First. Jonah, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
The New York Knicks team that featured Walt, Clyde, Frazier, Bill Bradley, Willis Reed, and Dave DeBuscher was no dynasty. The Knicks won championships in 1970, 1973, and that was that. But in his new book, When the Garden Was Eden, Harvey Araton contends that those Knicks, quote, gave fans a symbol of harmony that was especially welcome and necessary at the time. Harvey Araton joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Harvey, welcome back to Only a Game.
So great to be here, Bill.
First, in the interests of full disclosure, I grew up in New Jersey. I was a fan of those Knicks teams, particularly Walt Frazier. But tell me why those particular Knicks were any more symbols of harmony than any other successful basketball team.
Well, I think the Knicks were the perfect team for their time and place. And given the fact that they came of age in the late 60s and that their nice little run of 5 or 6 years, 3 finals, 2 titles, lasted into the early 70s, that the team provided something of a soothing element in New York at a time when the city was, and the country, of course, were going through tumult. It was a racially balanced team. It was a team that was considered the ultimate in sort of a democratic style of play. It was an intelligent, committed, and very charismatic team. You know, there was sort of like this sense of a Broadway play that symbolized the best of America at a time when the country was sorely lacking.
Perhaps the most dramatic single moment explored in your book involves a championship series Game 7, no surprise there, and it involves the sudden, somewhat unexpected appearance of Knicks center Willis Reed on the court.
He's 25 feet out left side, and he one-hands, and he hits. And apparently Willis Reed is all right. The Lakers have stopped, and they're just watching Willis go through his warm-ups.
Tell us a little bit about that moment, please.
He got hurt in Game 5 in the first quarter, and the Knicks miraculously won that fifth game. He did not play in Game 6 in Los Angeles when Wilt Chamberlain went off for 45 points and 27 rebounds. The team came out to warm up without him. A few minutes after that, an African-American player comes walking down the runway. The crowd rises to start cheering and then suddenly sits back down when they realize it's Cassie Russell. And So, you know, they're sitting there, fans are literally freaking out. And all of a sudden, after being shot up with, you know, with lots of drugs to numb the pain that was shooting down his leg, Willis makes his appearance. So that was really the first inkling. You know, I mean, today we would have had updates on Twitter 24/7.
He would have been updating us on Twitter.
Absolutely. You know, I'm sitting here getting shot up with the medication as I speak. So it was just an incredible rush for everybody. I mean, players who were on the court said, like, they felt as if the noise just level lifted everyone off the floor, that it was vibrating. You know, Willis comes out, hits the first two shots, really doesn't do very much at all after that. And I got to know Willis as well as, you know, the other principals on those teams. And by the time I was done, there was absolutely no doubt in my mind that Willis was not only the captain of that team, he was the heart and soul and really was pretty much responsible for everything that went on karma-wise with that team.
Lots of Knicks fans knew Walt Frazier as Clyde, the exemplar of ultimate cool, who wore fur coats and wide-brim hats and allegedly had a bachelor pad as fine as anything Joe Namath could have imagined. Was Walt Clyde?
Clyde was really kind of an alter ego created by Frazier in terms of the way he dressed and the way he acted and the image that he put forward to essentially compensate for the fact that he was a very shy man. And he didn't really have to do much. He didn't really have to even say much. He just allowed people. He would let photographers come in and shoot his bedroom with his mink-covered bed and the mirrors on his ceiling. And just the photos and the imagery, you know, created that whole persona for him.
I had known that Jerry Lucas, who was certainly a force on those Knicks teams, had various aptitudes that had nothing to do with basketball. I had not known that he was in the habit of ripping out pages of the New York phone book and memorizing them. Why did he do that?
Well, because, you know, as Dave DeBuscher liked to say, that he was, you know, the provider of endless, useless information. And Jerry's mind still works very differently. So he really, you know, saw New York, coming to New York, as an opportunity to kind of market himself, much like Walt Frazier, with his kind of strange abilities to retain information. I mean, he would do stuff like during timeouts, count the number of steps leading up an aisle to, you know, to the mezzanine level and turn around and say to DeBuscher, hey, you see that aisle over there? There's 300 steps walking up to the top. And he would rip out pages of the Manhattan telephone book. And he would take them on the road, and while Bill Bradley was reading up on politics and Phil Jackson was reading, you know, sophisticated novels, Lucas had, like, hidden in a, in his newspaper, let's say, the pages of the phone book, and he would memorize the entire directory. And then he would go on Johnny Carson and recite entire pages of the telephone directory while Carson would sit there in utter amazement. And he did wind up cashing in big time with that, you know, with this whole persona, because he wound up with a couple of magic shows on TV. He really did wind up making it a sort of an alternative career, which he still is involved in. He still does his sort of Jerry Lucas special learning, you know, processes that he writes books and does a lot of appearances.
Harvey, in researching this book, you spoke with all the available former Knicks. Do you have a sense of what, if anything, being a part of those teams still means to any of those former players today?
I think it's sort of like an old army unit or something that achieved great success in some battle. They really do believe, despite the gnashing of teeth in Boston over the attention the Knicks got, because let's face it, what they did was kind of a drop in the bucket compared to the Celtics. But again, the players, Bradley speaks about this eloquently in the book, the players really believe that they participated in something special and groundbreaking in terms of where professional basketball would go.
I'm speaking with Harvey Ariton, author of When the Garden Was Eden, and you're listening to Only a Game. As you point out in the book, Knicks fans have been enduring all manner of incompetence, buffoonery, and worse for many years now. Is there any reason to think that New Yorkers will see another edition of Eden-like days at their garden anytime soon?
Well, it's a fascinating discussion, that team, in terms of the modern sports era in New York, was probably the most beloved because in other sports, you know, the city was divided between National League and American League, AFL and NFL. But I do think that today's young people, today's fans, are conditioned in a different way than we were growing up with our sports teams. I mean, free agency was not even on the radar back in 1969-70. I think young fans today, my kids who love basketball, they're used to seeing teams being put together in what I like to call the microwave. So, you know, Carmelo Anthony, let's say Amari Stoudemire is signed as a free agent, and then Carmelo Anthony comes aboard. And there's a possibility, depending on the outcome of the current labor negotiations, that Chris Paul or someone of that nature could be added to the team in the next year and a half or so. But I think young fans are more of accepting of that. And so the way they would become completely immersed in, you know, a team and their pursuit of a championship is different from the way we did. So if you talk to a lot of today's fans who are 35, 30 years old, when you say good old days, they think of John Starks dunking over Michael Jordan. You know, Peter DeBuscher, who I interview in the book, Dave's son, wasn't born for that first championship. So when he talks about, you know, his favorite days as a Knicks fan, it's those days in the 90s when they played against Jordan and Reggie Miller, and he would sit at courtside with his father before his dad died in 2003. That's his good old days. So the perspective of the fan, I think, will shape the kind of love affair that eventually is created if the Knicks continue to grow as a team.
Harvey Ariton is the author of When the Garden Was Eden, Clyde the Captain, Dollar Bill, and the Glory Days of the New York Knicks. The book is published by Harper, and the author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Harvey, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's always a pleasure. I enjoy it.
Say, go New York, go New York, go! On the floor, scoring more is 94, and the Knicks are hardcore. And I'll tell you like this, we ain't never looked sharper. With Hubert, Bonner, Gray, and Harper, it's the Knicks, and we're back on pace. Everyone's gearing up for the championship race, and the fans are going crazy, and they're doing it for a reason. Cause 94 is the Knickerbocker season. You better believe the Knicks got all that takes. We're shooting three pointers, and we're running fast breaks. And if your defense makes a mistake, then bam, you ain't dunks in your face. This is a team you don't wanna miss. We are New York. We are the New York Knicks. Go New York, go New York, go!
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
Indonesia and Malaysia have traditionally argued about maritime territories and the origin of various culinary delights. They've also argued about soccer, and they continue to do so. In the first leg of a recent competition between the two nations, the Indonesian players walked off the field, claiming that Malaysian fans were assaulting them with laser beams. They lost the game 3-0. Last weekend, fans of the Indonesian team were frustrated when they found that all 88,000 tickets for the second leg of the competition had been sold, so they set a ticket booth on fire. Hard as it may be to believe, that tactic failed. No additional tickets materialized. Neither could anybody see that the maritime disputes or the food controversies had been much affected by the burning ticket booth. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, making big real-world money in the cyber world of professional electronic sports. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a look at the week's news and a happy belated Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Bill.
Thursday found many NFL fans giving thanks for the opportunity to watch pro football from 12:30 Eastern time until about midnight or whenever they fell into a stupor. How many of those games made viewers happy that they'd tuned in?
Well, a couple of them, especially the Cowboys-Miami game, and I would argue the Baltimore game as well, Baltimore-San Francisco game as well, made people very happy for tryptophan oblivion because it wasn't very good football. The only thing we demonstrated yesterday is that the Green Bay Packers are a very, very good football team, and Detroit Lions defensive lineman Ndamukong Suh has a boatload of talent, the coolest translated first name of any football player in NFL history, and it's time for him to stop being an idiot.
Wait a minute. You're telling me you don't believe that it took stomping on a guy three times for that young man to regain his balance?
That's right, because on those rare nights in college where I was a little unsteady coming home from the bistros, I could not walk a straight line until after I'd stomped on a guy's head at least three times. It's necessary to maintain your balance, to find a cranium to walk on.
Okay, so you're on.
No, I don't believe him as far as I can throw Ndamukong Suh.
Not very far.
And that's not. However, he can throw me across the room.
It is college football's rivalry week, Charlie, with the LSU-Arkansas game out of the way. Which of today's tilts will you be watching?
At 3:30, I'll be watching Alabama and Auburn, because Auburn could really foul up the BCS in a gigantic way if they manage to beat Alabama.
On Thursday, Texas beat Texas A&M. The score was 27-25 on a field goal as time expired. The Aggies will join the SEC next season. Are you one of those who were sad to see the end of that century-old rivalry?
Actually, I was, because it was one of the few I remember watching from the time I was a kid. It was always on Thanksgiving Day. It didn't really matter if you knew anything about either one of the teams. It was the football game you watch at your grandmother's house after the turkey was done. So, yes, I will be.
An anonymous letter sent to the admissions office at the University of Hawaii charged that players there had been playing poorly in order to enable gamblers to win money on Hawaii's games. The Honolulu Police Department has said there isn't enough information to open a criminal investigation. Hawaii hasn't beaten the point spread in 2 months, but maybe they're just a bad team, right?
That could be a bad team. I don't understand why the guy sent the money to I don't understand why the guy sent the letter to the admissions office. I mean, did it say, let me into your university or I will accuse you of point shaving?
He had his eye on the future. Be more careful about players you admit to this university. I don't know either.
You know what? I'll bet it's the first office listed alphabetically when you look up University of Hawaii and you don't want to send it to the switchboard.
That's probably right. This week, Milwaukee Brewers third baseman Ryan Braun was awarded the 2011 National League MVP Award, and his American League counterpart is Detroit ace Justin Verlander. He's the first starting pitcher to win an MVP in 25 years. Good choice?
Yes, both of them very good choices. Ryan Braun is a terrific player, and I noticed that he lives in Malibu and not in Milwaukee in the offseason, which I can't...
Shocked.
Having lived in Milwaukee in the winter, I can hardly blame him. I'm really happy for him. Justin Verlander was the most valuable player in the American League, because without him, the Detroit Tigers are not noticed after June.
And now we get to see whether Justin Verlander will henceforth sign baseball's Cy Young / MVP, the way Roger Clemens did when he achieved that distinction.
Well, we can only hope Justin doesn't have to sign any affidavits as MVP Cy Young winner.
Pittsburgh Penguins star Sidney Crosby returned to the ice this week, Charlie. A concussion had knocked him out of action for nearly a year, so he must have been pretty rusty, right?
Yeah, he only had 4-point night for the 21st time in his career and made a dinner out of the New York Islanders, which he's apparently done his entire career. So it's very good to have him back. Cross your fingers that nothing like this happens to him again.
Basketball Hall of Famer Julius Erving sold off about $3.5 million worth of his rings and various other memorabilia this week. Any idea who bought the stuff?
Oh, the Philadelphia 76ers bought a ton of it. They bought 10 lots containing 18 items from his personal collection. This is part of a campaign to get Dr. J back into the organization in Philadelphia in some capacity, so I'm assuming this will help.
Tony Stewart won the Sprint Cup title on Sunday. Does this result delight Mr. NASCAR?
Well, I mean, it does delight you. What does delight me is the fact that the Sprint Cup worked out exactly the way people wanted it to work out, which is it came down to a 2- and 3-point difference in the last race of the year. So I think NASCAR's got to be thrilled with this.
We made fun of Tiger Woods last week for losing his first match at the President's Cup by a record-breaking margin. So I think it's only fair to acknowledge that Tiger Woods captured the point that sealed a win in that competition for the U.S. on Sunday.
Yes, he won. He scored 1 point and the USA won. Congratulations. But it looks like he was happier than any of the times he ever won
big
the U.S.
Smile,
Open.
Big yeah. smile. Last week, a quartet of pensioners in England was dealt a whist hand that defies the odds and human comprehension when each was dealt a full suit. Each of the four, one got hearts, one got clubs, etc. The odds of this happening are about 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000. So can you think of any other occurrences that are about as likely to transpire?
I don't believe a word these elderly prevaricators are saying.
They're old.
I don't believe them any more than I believe Ndamukong Suh was trying to regain his balance by stomping on a guy's head three times. I think these people are dealing in barefaced non-facts.
Oh, dear. And finally, Charlie, Thursday marked the 10th anniversary of that other great Thanksgiving Day sports tradition, the National Dog Show, and I want you to admit it, you watched, right?
I watched none of it, thank you very much, although it was probably more exciting than any of the football games were. But congratulations to Ira, the wire-haired Fox Terrier, who won the National Dog Show. I'm quite amazed that that we've had a decade of Thanksgiving Day National Dog Shows. I didn't see that one coming.
Charlie Pierce writes the politics blog for Esquire magazine, and of course he joins me here at Only a Game each week at this time as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
For months, our NBA stories have been about large, wealthy men glaring across the table at smaller, wealthier men. I wonder if they've talked any about whether they'll need to do anything to win back the fans. If so, one school of thought will have had it that when the electricity comes on in the arenas across the land, the people will shout, "Look, shiny lights!" while tripping over each other on the way to the box office. The argument will be that our citizenry has no memory, even for insults. The counter-argument? The players should walk into the crowd to shake hands and sign stuff. The teams should give away plastic keychains and stuffed mascots festooned with logos. Lowering ticket prices will have occurred to nobody, and because the owners and players increase the take by playing as many games as can be jammed into what is laughingly referred to as the basketball season, nobody will have suggested an abbreviated season, even when it isn't made necessary by a lockout. And that's too bad. I'm not saying they should always start the NBA season on Christmas, although that might be kind of fun, but who besides those counting the take wouldn't welcome a shorter edition? In the NBA season as we've come to know it, some players have acknowledged that they can't get excited about every game. That means some number of paying customers get cheated of the opportunity to see the athletes playing as hard as they can. The long season beats players up to the extent that postseason games often hinge on who's healthier. Not healthy, because by mid-April, nobody who's been playing NBA basketball several times a week since November 1st is healthy. Healthier. Then there's the playoff format. There's much to be said for a best-of-seven-game series, especially when it goes seven games and provides intriguing storylines. But what if the first round of playoffs and even the second was win or go home? One game. It works for March Madness and, of course, the NFL postseason. Major League Baseball's going to try it when they add two more wild card teams. I suppose there's no chance it'll happen in the NBA, but hasn't it been fun to hear some pro basketball talk that doesn't involve deadlines, name-calling, and lawsuits? Close your eyes and picture the Major League Baseball logo. Blue on the left, red on the right, with a batter's silhouette in the middle. It's the same for the NBA, except it's Jerry West's profile as the focal point. Major League Gaming's logo follows form, featuring a white silhouette of a video game controller. But logos aren't the only thing Major League Gaming has in common with pro baseball and basketball. There's some serious money involved. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story from last weekend's MLG National Finals in Providence, Rhode Island.
The next game happens, and what's our next game type, Corey?
That's going to bring us to Search and Destroy on Firing Range here with Eon Envy and Quantic Next Threat. And
from one of four broadcast booths behind the main gaming floor at the Rhode Island Convention Center, Corey Dunn and Golden Boy, snazzily dressed and sitting behind a shiny black desk, look like any other sportscasters on ESPN. Only this feed is being beamed by satellite truck to the internet and 1 million viewers in 175 countries, the same number that broadcast the NFL.
You've got high-definition cameras, you've got sportscasters, you've got the game feeds. It's a pretty big production.
Sundance DiGiovanni is the co-founder and CEO of MLG, and he doesn't like getting into a debate over whether his league is a sport.
Video games are arguably the next great wave. I mean, we produce this as sport, you know, from the streams to the stars within the league, the excitement in the room. You know, it's if it looks like a sport and talks like a sport and walks like a sport, it's kind of a sport.
20,000 participants and spectators will jockey for a good view of the jumbo screens in the convention center over the course of the weekend. And countless more are gathering together in living rooms and bars to watch as four national championships are awarded over 3 days.
There's a huge audience for what we do. And it's a young, vocal audience with a disposable income that wants to support what we do. So it's all in the presentation, and that's what we spent a lot of time really mastering, is making this something that people can gather together to watch and enjoy as a spectator, not just as a participant.
Out on the floor, every chair and much of the standing room is filled with that mostly young audience staring intently at the action. Underneath the enormous video screens, two teams of four are frantically pushing buttons on their controllers and shouting out commands as they compete in the grand final for Call of Duty Black Ops.
15 seconds left in the game. Can Virus do it? Can he be the hero of next year, the hero of Quantic Gaming? He managed to take one guy out!
The room erupts with excitement as a guy called Virus seals the victory for his team, Quantic Next Threat. A few minutes later, MLG CEO Sundance DiGiovanni puts a large presentation check for $50,000 into the eager hands of 17-year-old Doug Martin, a.k.a. Censor, who promises to put the money toward college. Joe DeLuca is studying communication at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. In Call of Duty, he's known as Merc, and he's had a little success of his own.
These tournaments, they have good money, but I myself, a few months ago, we won the $1 million tournament, and that was $400,000 for first, so I personally made $100,000 just off one tournament, so it's pretty good.
DeLuca says his parents weren't too sure about his hobby until he started bringing home paychecks. And now?
I mean, my mom's right there, so. Mom, what do you?
Clearly she's supportive.
Yeah, she's very supportive of this. I mean.
Angus is great today.
Yeah. They are good. They're good grades, chill.
An hour after he was handed a check almost as tall as he is, Doug Martin is still carrying it around. His team captain, Blake Campbell, doubts he'll ever put it down.
When we get back to the hotel, yeah, a couple hours.
Probably not.
Feels nice walking around with this thing, you know. Everyone's stopping and saying congratulations to us. It just feels great. After all this time to win, and it's just the best feeling I've ever had so far.
Campbell's been playing seriously since junior high. Martin insists his passion began when he was just 8 years old. But neither of them ever thought they'd be hoisting around checks for $50,000 and more.
Not a chance, no.
No one thought it would get this big, and it's only getting bigger, so it's life-changing, it really is.
As the Call of Duty fans clear out, Ian Helmar from Beverly, Massachusetts, snags a prime seat to watch his game, League of Legends. He doesn't often get the chance to watch in person, but when he has the time, he likes to tune in to see the pros online.
They stream on websites that allow you to put ads on your stream, so they have live streams of them playing while they play during the day, practice, and they make ad money off of that. So the most popular players will get, they'll be streaming in the middle of the day on a weekday, and they'll get 6,000 viewers.
6,000 people watching someone else practice is nothing compared to the passion of fans of StarCraft II, a game so dominated by Koreans that everyone else is simply called a foreigner.
Hey, bro!
The StarCraft gallery includes two shirtless guys with their favorite team logo painted on their chests and numbers of fans, mostly women, holding up homemade signs for their favorite players. StarCraft II is an individual game, but players form teams that generally live together, share incomes, and train against each other. Daily programs on Twitch TV, an online video source for gamers, keep fans on top of the latest strategies. Though I'm told that the game maker Blizzard recently made StarCraft II more spectator-friendly, sometimes the MLG casters sound like they're speaking a foreign language.
That's a good replay to study, by the way, because Leenok, one of the things he did is he was baiting the stalkers to the corner of the base with the mutas, and then he had infestors on the low ground that he fungled and then used the hydras to kill the stalkers.
Yeah.
Like, who does that? That is so smart and intelligent play, so you got to watch out.
Well, guys, it is time now for game number two as we head to Team Slayer on Sanctuary.
At the far end of the hall, the Halo National Championship is being contested, blissfully free of Mutas, Infestors, and Hydras. I'm still confused. So is Marie Markowski, who's here with her 18-year-old son, Steve.
It's interesting what a mother will do for her children.
Marie says she's useless with a game controller in her hands, but she's solidly supportive of her son's passion.
This is going to be one of the biggest industries in the next 5 years. It is phenomenal. He's actually going to school for graphic design, and he hopes to do something with this genre because it's a sport for kids who wouldn't normally do another type of sport. So they love it.
Major League Gaming now enters its off-season, during which new versions of games will be adopted, teams will trade players, and college students will have a little extra time to study. Competition begins again in the spring. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Special thanks this week to Paul Veitkis. Our intern is Jillian Geib. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen Given's Major League Gaming photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes courtesy of one of Major League Gaming's two tournament announcers.
Unfreaking believable, ladies and gentlemen. MLG could not write this. I couldn't write this because I have horrible grammar.
Why should grammar even matter? All you need is a strong grasping of the source code, what do you call it, and the handle, the little buttons there, and you're all... I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And American Jewish World Service, supporting local solutions to global challenges at ajws.org. This is NPR.